much, Sophie, and thank you also to the organising committee for the invitation to speak today. It's a great pleasure to open, if you like, the scientific programme of the conference. A plan of attack. I'm going to start by talking about notions of resource and resource system. It's important to remember this is not something on which researchers have a monopoly. These are terms that are used in the professional world and in everyday language. So I'm going to start from there. I'm then going to go back in time, not quite as far as Christine is going to take us this evening, but to probably what I'm going to argue is the most significant kind of resource system ever created in mathematics, to Euclid's Elements. And I'm going to fast forward from that. Euclid's period of influence was around 2,000 years. I'm then going to move to the 20th century, when Euclid was thrust aside and replaced, and then to the present and to current ideas in research about a resource system. So let's get started on notions of resource. So in everyday established usage, a resource is some kind of asset. It's typically monetary, material, or human, and it provides some form of support. But there's a more specialized use of the word that's grown up in the field of education around about the 1960s, and I'll explain why that was. It referred specifically to curriculum-related materials which were intended to support teaching or learning activity. And this is a usage that's still predominant in the professional field amongst teachers. But of course, in the research field, the idea or other ideas of resource system have developed, and I'm going to talk about those in due course. So why did this new term resource come about? How did the era of resources come into being? Essentially, it came about because of a broadening of the range of technologies available to support the production of teaching and learning materials. The audiovisual, reprographic facilities, and this made it very much easier to produce and reproduce these kinds of resources. And of course, more recently, we've seen a shift towards the digitalization of resources and accessing them online. So over the last 50 years, there's been an unprecedented change, if you like, in the technological conditions under which the resources for teaching can be produced. And we've seen the institutionalization of this trend in, when I was a child in school, I went along to the school library. But nowadays, we go to the school resource center, and that term dates back to the 1960s. And it signals a parallel pedagogical shift towards, well, what's usually called resource-based learning or resource-based teaching, can of course have different definitions, but what it's about is more independent study by students and more active curriculum design by teachers. So that's resource. What about the idea of a resource system? I did a little troll through Google Scholar and found indeed that the term resource system was in fairly widespread use during the 1960s and 70s. But if we go right back to the idea of system, the central idea there is the one of organization. So on the one hand, you can use the term system to refer to a structure that results from multiple entities being organized to form a functioning whole. So the system is the functioning whole. On the other hand, the term can refer to some scheme or method which provides the basis for that type of organization. So that within the professional field, we see two corresponding notions of a resource system. One usage, and it's really expanding the notion of the textbook, refers to systematic curriculum schemes which are being created through combining diverse resources to form a coherent program. Another usage of the term resource system, and this one expands the notion of the library, refers to organizing and cataloging a repository of resources in a systematic manner so as to make the contents more readily searchable and usable. And of course, as I've said before, there have been further notions of resource system, which I'm going to talk about in due course within the research field. But I think it's important to start with the professional field and the ideas of resource system in the professional field. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to look at what I think are two illuminating historical exemplars, and I'll claim that these are resource systems in mathematics teaching avant la lettre. First, let me say why I think these can be considered resource systems and in what sense, because what I think is important is to look at the way in which these texts organize many smaller resource units which make them up. What's the systematic principle behind these? So let's start with Euclid and the elements. You're all familiar with this, the history of teaching and learning mathematics. This is the resource that towers above all others in terms of its longevity and its influence. Euclid created his elements around 300 years before the Christian era, and it was subsequently annotated and adapted by others into more than 1,000 editions. Has any book in mathematics had so many editions? And been published in so many languages. The picture I used on the title page of my talk shows Abelard of Bath, who was the translator from the Arabic of the elements into a Latin version, and of course the Arabic version had already been translated from the Greek. So in one form or another, the elements was widely studied until the early years of the 20th century. What Euclid achieved was to combine and adapt mathematical sources to produce a comprehensive and coherent text, providing a logically systematic exposition of a core of classical mathematics. And he was able to do this thanks to a remarkable institution in Alexandria where he practiced, the Library of Alexandria. Through various means, some nefarious, the Library of Alexandria had assembled resources from all across the ancient world. So Euclid was able to draw on disparate mathematical texts to compile the elements. Texts by Pythagoras, Hippocrates, Eudoxus, Theaetetus, father and son, and many, many others. The result provides a prime example of Hilbert's nostrum, that the importance of a great book is determined, and I quote here, by the number of previous publications it makes superfluous to read. So what Euclid did was a digest of this core of classical mathematics. But of course, he did far more than that. He introduced a way of organizing that knowledge, which has had the most enormous influence on mathematics itself, but also on all disciplines. So the organizing principle is one of logical deduction, and it was organized within a particular template. I'm not going to go through that in detail. This is from Heath, the slide I'm showing, and this is Proclus's analysis of the template around which each proposition in the elements is presented, and many of you will be familiar with that. And if you ever get to reading the full version of this talk, which will appear in the conference book, this will be explained in more detail. But I'm pretty sure that many of you have had close encounters with Euclid and his elements, so therefore you understand this notion of definitions, postulates, common notions, and from these being derived propositions. And then the way each proposition is set out with an enunciation, a setting out, a definition or specification, a construction or mechanism, leading to the proof, and then finally back to the conclusion, which shows how it relates to the original enunciation. So there's a very clear way of structuring, organizing the resources that enters into Euclid's elements, and which has been very, very significant. So it provides a means of gaining access, not just to the substantive mathematical content of the disparate sources that Euclid drew from, but to the logical method that he employed to organize these sources systematically. So that over time, the elements came to fulfill an important sociocognitive function as a canonical text. It provided a shared framework, both of substantive knowledge and argumentative forms, and that supported and shaped the diffusion and development of mathematical knowledge. In particular, the elements found favor within an influential approach to liberal education, an approach based on exposing students to the classical models of thought displayed in great books. Indeed, the elements were studied less for its mathematical content than for the habits of mind that such study was thought to inculcate. Induction into the Euclidean system through what I can't resist calling exposure to the elements was intended to teach students to reason in the abstract realm removed from sensory perception. However, in practice, things could be very, very different. This abstract realm removed from sensory perception was not necessarily what students experienced. So, for example, in England at the beginning of the 20th century, we find the reformer Perry criticizing one of the requirements to gain a pass degree at Oxford University. Perry objected to the exercise, which was the students had to memorize two books of Euclid, even down to the lettering of figures. And there was certainly no question of them doing any original geometrical exercises. So what had happened was that the elements had become associated with a very reductive mnemonic pedagogy. And not surprisingly, there was a contemporary reform movement really throughout the 19th century, which gained the ascendancy at the beginning of the 20th century, so that the great book, Euclid's Elements, gave way to the school book, the textbook specifically written with teaching and learning in mind. And in the case of geometry, these texts placed more emphasis on practical experimentation, because in Euclid, of course, that wasn't the important matter. You were meant to be operating in an abstract world. So I'm going to look at a typical 20th century textbook, again, looking at it as a resource system. And I'm going to argue that Jurel's A New Geometry exemplifies a systematic didactical organization of resources. Just a little bit about Jurel. This particular text was first published in 1939, and according to my copy, which was printed in 1945, it was reprinted no less than once and often twice in each of the following years. Indeed, Jurel has been described by Douglas Quadling in a review that Douglas wrote of English maths textbooks in the 20th century as the most prolific author of the century, quotes, so that his quotes, his name was for many pupils synonymous with mathematics. So this is a, that's a justification for choosing this as a typical text. Now, you'll be very pleased to know that at the beginning of his preface, Jurel acknowledges a process of documentational genesis in the production of this work, because he published his very first geometry textbook in 1909, and many others followed before he embarked on writing A New Geometry in Schools, which was published 30 years later. So he talks about the way in which feedback on his previous books, he remained a teacher throughout his career, so he got feedback in that way and from his colleagues at Winchester College where he taught, but also from many other teachers, and he was active in the Mathematical Association, which in those years before the Second World War produced regular reports on different aspects of the teaching of mathematics. So all of these, he explains, went into his design of this text. Can I apologize? My copy is very old and faded. It's printed on that wartime paper that's incredibly thin and discolors very, very easily. So my scan is not the most wonderful scan. But then this is one of the problems of resources, isn't it? That you actually have to just make do with what's there. Well, what was significant about Jurel? I can pick out one particular thing. In his preface, he sets out very clearly his didactically inspired organizational scheme for the systematic sequencing of activity within each topical unit of the text. And those of you that are familiar with the notions of stage A, stage B, and stage C geometry, promulgated by the Mathematical Association, will recognize some of the influence of that on this. So it starts with oral discussion, and that lays the ground for everything else that's going to follow. Practical to the last, Jurel makes sure that he provides a textbook that will make it easy for teachers to refer to diagrams in the textbook or to put them up onto the board because they're already there and prepared. This was one of the reasons for the popularity of his texts. He follows that up with an exercise of numerical examples. Now, this is a world away from the abstract realm, you know, removed from all sort of empirical, reference. He then goes into the thing that's most recognizably like the elements, formal proofs of the corresponding theorems. But the key thing is that he doesn't seek to prove all theorems. He seeks to find a key theorem and group ideas together so that there's a better balance between different approaches to geometry. And then, four, there's a thing that was missing from the degree requirements at Oxford University, which is you actually have to learn to tackle new and unfamiliar geometrical problems using the ideas that you've already encountered. So there is a very explicit didactical system underpinning the organization of resources in Jurel's textbook. And of course, consistent use of this scheme throughout the main part of the textbook accustoms teacher and pupils to the different stages. And that, by making that habitual and routine, it leaves space for teacher and students to focus on the mathematics, on the mathematical thinking, and on learning the mathematics, rather than having to take time every time they come to a new activity or a new topic, not just to understand the mathematics, but to make sense of actually how things are organized and how the resource works. So, this core part of the text corresponds to one aspect of the resource system, and in particular the first sense. It's the systematic program of activity and work. But there are other features of the text that are more like the second notion of a resource system, something that you can, in this case, come back to access information. So, you know, the obvious things, there's a properly done index, because in those days we couldn't rely on searching electronic documents, so good indexes were very important in getting access. There's provision for students not just to meet ideas for the first time, but there are review exercises, and there's a listing of all the theorems and constructions at the end. So basically, this text is designed to be the complete thing that will support the teaching and learning of a course in geometry. And it's this explicit and systematic didactical organization which makes Jurel's text identifiably a textbook. Now, you may be feeling, so why is he talking about these in the context of talking about teachers' resource systems? The reason is that I think it's really important to understand, you know, this historically well-established notion of a scholarly text or a textbook as organizing what otherwise would be units of resource in a comprehensive and systematic way, because that's the background to any consideration of teachers' resource systems. Because we're now moving into the era of a multi-source collection of resources and creating from that some kind of organized system. So as resource-based approaches to teaching and learning became increasingly influential, there was a shift away from the traditional model of a single course text. And one can probably date that back to, again, the 1960s and 1970s. At that time, it wasn't a major trend. It was relatively unusual for schools and teachers to be doing this. But there were some important forerunners. So in England, for example, in some London schools, there was a project called SMILE, which was very much ahead of its time in seeking to bring together teachers to share and organize resources, eventually to develop a complete secondary school course in mathematics, organized in such a way that teachers could put in and take out units of their own, resource units of their own, but having the benefit of a fully complete system that if they wanted to, they could use. The other really innovative thing that happened in the 1980s was the development, in parallel with this, of a graduated assessment scheme. And that gave a system which was organized around criteria which described specific cognitively based strategies which represented significant steps in mathematical development. So here we have, on paper, a comprehensive system with a curriculum map and an assessment framework into which teachers could slot their own resources and with teachers working together to fill the system. And of course, there are now many, in the digital era, many modern counterparts of this. A particularly ambitious one that some of you may have heard Jer Confrey talking about is in the US, the Math Mapper digital learning system, which is organized around learning trajectories. And this, you know, rather as Smile did in its paper-based ways, tries to set appropriate learning targets and to identify corresponding learning opportunities, in other words, the resources to support these. And then it makes diagnostic assessments that provide feedback on the success of these efforts and analyzes progress to inform the next steps. So what we're seeing is, with digitalization, the possibility of really creating highly functional systems for doing this kind of thing. It's worth noting, however, that initiatives such as SMILE eventually developed into comprehensive curriculum programs, which were distributed well beyond the contributing schools and teachers, and really became much more like textbook schemes, but in a slightly different format from a textbook. And indeed, that was became by far the most common use of SMILE. And equally, in France, one thinks of SISAMAT, where clearly there's a group of teachers working very, very hard on developing and revising SISAMAT, but one suspects that for many of the users of SISAMAT, it's used much more as a conventional textbook would be. And in the same way, MathMapper recognizes that it's quite challenging to insert local resources into just a shell system which doesn't have any curriculum materials in it. So as I understand it, MathMapper comes with resources pre-populated, and teachers can choose if they want to replace and substitute those. And what these trends indicate is the continuing importance of comprehensive, externally developed systems of resources in supporting mathematics education in many schools. So now to turn to the research field. And I want to look at some recent research that's approached the idea of resource system through the teacher. And it's looked in particular at how teachers develop professional knowledge through the process of appropriating diverse resources to turn them into functional tools for teaching. And one way of thinking about this is those of us who are old enough to remember using the same textbook for a number of years will remember how, as we used it, a lot of our knowledge about teaching with this textbook became enriched and became tied up with the particular way in which the textbook presented knowledge, the particular exercises it set, and so on. So what this is doing is the research field starting to acknowledge this, but looking at it in an era where teachers are often being much more eclectic in the resources that they're drawing on. So I'm first going to look at the evolving notion of classroom resource system in the structuring features framework. This framework was created to eliminate the development of teachers' professional knowledge as it was required to incorporate digital mathematical tools into their classroom practice. And resource system was one of five elements in that. It refers to the different material resources in use in the classroom and to the way in which their use is organized and made functional. And particularly what I had in mind when I developed this was previous work which had pointed out some tensions and stresses between, in the same classroom, teachers using more traditional resources alongside new digital resources, and a lack of match between these and challenges of fitting them together. So the original paper outlining this used an illustrative example, which came from an earlier study, of the evolving classroom practice of a mathematics teacher introducing the use of dynamic geometry software to his practice. So, a little bit about this teacher. So the first thing was that the teacher had a rationale for integrating the new tool into his classroom resource system, and he was trying to make it work. Essentially, he wanted the new tool to complement established construction tasks using classical tools by introducing new tasks with the dynamic software. And his rationale for doing this was twofold. First, he felt that having constructions mediated by named software actions strengthened attention to the geometrical ideas involved. And the second reason was that he felt that using the dynamic geometry compared to using classical tools made it possible to give students a much richer experience of finding geometric rules and patterns through exploring a dynamic figure, and that this was impossible, would be impossible with static diagrams. So in the second respect, he was quite happy with the new resource and the resource system that it created. But in the first sense, he was a little bit unhappy because he felt that the correspondence between classical and digital techniques was a bit imperfect, because there wasn't the kind of congruence that he'd hoped for between the old and new tools. There wasn't perfect alignment, if you like, of the constructs and concepts that they used. So part of the notion of resource system is the rationale behind the joint use of different resources. And here, the teacher is largely satisfied with the way that the rationale plays out in the classroom, but has some reservations. The other aspect of this is that to implant new resources in the classroom may mean that you have to develop new techniques and norms. And this teacher had experienced some difficulties in getting the classroom resource system functioning effectively. In resolving these, he'd had to develop some new techniques and norms, and he'd extended his professional knowledge accordingly. So, for example, he was developing knowledge not just of how the nuances of software operation might derail students' attempts at construction. I'm stuck, it's not working. He had found ways of turning such difficulties to advantage in reinforcing the mathematical focus that he wanted the task to have. So he found that quite constructive, and he was getting more accomplished in knowing how to do that. So it's a bit like in the old days with the textbook, becoming much more familiar with an exercise and strategies for handling students' difficulties with a particular task. He also recognized already from doing these kinds of activities just by hand that students didn't always appreciate the significant geometrical properties of a figure. So he gets them to draw a triangle, construct a perpendicular bisectus. To him, it's remarkable that they all meet in one point. To the students, oh, so what? Is that something special? And so he's developing techniques of using dragging, of talking about it, of getting them to think about it, which start to make it remarkable to the students. Again, extending his professional knowledge. I could give you many examples. I'll just give you one more. More prosaically, he found, as I think many of us have, is that students are very attracted by the presentational possibilities that software presents. So changing fonts, changing colors, you know, making your work look more attractive. And so in other words, he recognized that he had to do something and stop this turning into an exercise in presentation rather than in geometry. And he did that by providing an example and talking about helpful ways of using the presentational facilities for mathematical purposes. So what would be good use of, for example, color coding? Or under what circumstances is it sensible to use different fonts and so on? So he was trying to set up some socio-mathematical norms around the use of the presentational facilities in order that, again, the resource system would function in a smooth and effective manner. So, later work looked at more directly using the structuring features framework with my doctoral student Gulay Bozkurt. She studied the classroom practice of three teachers. And just to summarize that, I'm going to look in particular a comparison of the least and most technologically experienced teachers. And what they were both doing was they were trying to establish a resource system that accorded both with their didactical preferences, but also with their level of comfort with the technology. So there were quite a lot of similarities in the classroom resource systems that they established. In previous work, I'd found that some teachers chose not to have students make use of dynamic geometry for themselves. It was just a teacher's demonstration tool. And they used a kind of cost-benefit argument for that, which was that the investment they would have to make in preparing students to use the dynamic software just didn't pay off in terms of the return in learning that the students would get. But both these teachers felt that there was value in students making use of the software, rather like the one that I described a moment ago, because they felt that working with it and the mediation that it provided of activity was going to be helpful to learning. Again, we spend the whole of primary school developing students' literacy so that they can work with the printed and written word, and secondary school teachers tend to assume, although it's not always the case, that students come to them at secondary level already proficient in the use of texts and the written and the printed word. It's often forgotten that that's necessary with respect to other tools. So for example, in the programs developed in England after the national curriculum reforms at the beginning of the millennium, there were lots of nice pictures which showed dynamic geometry screens, but there wasn't any recognition that it would be necessary to, if pupils were going to use it, to prepare them to use it. Maybe the assumption was that only teachers would use it. So in the national curriculum schemes, there were whole pages about learning to use a protractor, but there was nothing about students learning to make use of a dynamic geometry system. So these teachers broke this down. They operated a little by little principle. So rather than having a big number of lessons on learning to use dynamic geometry, they drip fed as needed the ideas in. And again, this maybe looks an absolutely sort of, you know, prosaic aspect of a resource system, but it's a really crucial thing in deciding how it is that you're going to develop students' proficiency with a new tool. And typically they assigned the first task to give students experience in using the new features for themselves. Again, very typically, what they provided students with was prepared dynamic files and an accompanying printed worksheet that usually gave instructions on how students should use the files, and it set aside space for them to record predictions and report findings. Because perhaps the most interesting thing in common between the teachers' classroom resource systems was that they were both making use of the ability within a dynamic software system of the provision of feedback to students, which would help students become self-testing and self-correcting. There are also some quite important differences in the resource systems. So comparing the most experienced technologically teacher with the least experienced, here are some of the differences. The most experienced teacher, not surprisingly, had refined his own files and worksheet duos over a lengthy period, whereas the least experienced teacher went online, found a duo that looked promising, and thought, I'll give it a whirl. The degree of task direction and closure was different. the least experienced teacher gave the online duo a whirl and found it was difficult to manage. So she started the process of documentational genesis by rewriting the worksheet. And the way in which she rewrote the borrowed worksheet was to provide much more explicit direction towards particular outcomes, because what she wanted to have was something that she was confident would lead to those outcomes. On the other hand, the most experienced teacher, although the task environments that he provided were quite tightly and carefully constrained to avoid students having difficulties that were not relevant to the mathematical focus, in other respects, they were much more open. And this allowed students to explore different solution strategies. The last difference is the balance between media. Again, the least experienced teacher rewrote the borrowed worksheet, and she decided that she wanted to add some more worksheets that would be done strictly as pencil or pen and paper exercises, because she felt that students needed practice on paper of what they had seen on the computer. So the computer is positioned as a site where new mathematical ideas are introduced, but not the principal site of mathematical activity. The principal site of mathematical activity remains pencil and paper, pen and paper. On the other hand, the most experienced teacher, the site of mathematical activity, by and large, was in the dynamic environment. And in particular, he made a lot of use of projecting students' solutions onto the screen so that the whole class could have discussions of the mathematics in the digital environment. So I think from that, I hope you start to get a feeling of what different resource systems might look like and what some of the main variables in terms of teachers' resource systems might be. Some critical reflection on the framework, and in particular its use of the idea of classroom resource system. My sort of principal criticism would be that it's been used in a loosely defined manner, which is quite helpful when you're still exploring the idea. It has the advantage of ensuring that the construct is well grounded empirically, because you use empirical examples to start to define what it is. And it allows quite a lot of flexibility in identifying relevant phenomena and accommodating them, so you don't close things down too early. On the other hand, I do think that as our knowledge of such phenomena grows, particularly across a wider range of educational contexts, it would be beneficial to demarcate the construct in a more precise manner and to break it down into component parts and clarify their interaction. One of the reasons that it's been hard to do that is that my particular interest was in the use of digital tools in teaching. And unfortunately, educational policy in England since 2010 has been very discouraging of the use of these mathematical tools in the classroom, simply by virtue of the reforms to the curriculum and the way in which it's positioned technology as a marginal feature of the classroom. So I think if people are going to do what I think would be something useful, they'll have to do it in countries other than England. So let's come to another country where perhaps the conditions have been more propitious to this kind of research, to France, and to the notions of resource and document in the documentational approach. So lots of other people are going to talk about the documentational approach in this conference. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to focus particularly on the way in which resource system is used. But first, I need just to remind you of three important points about the documentational approach. So the first important point is it adopts an expansive notion of resource. Not just material resources, but non-material human and cultural assets. So it's a very wide-ranging notion of resource. Second, whereas, for example, structuring features is focused on the classroom, documentational approach is interested with the resource teachers, systems of teachers over the whole span of their professional activity. So in particular, it looks very carefully at the use of resources in the preparation of lessons as well as in the implementation of lessons. And the third, I think, important point is that in the psychologically influenced documentational approach, there's a crucial distinction between the artifact, the resource, and the result of its appropriation by the user, perhaps in combination with other resources. So you get the instrument or the document, and that comprises the resource itself plus an associated utilization scheme. So that's the psychological influence on the way in which things are framed. And that utilization scheme, there are things we can see, which are usages, and there are things that we infer as lying behind the structuring, the pattern in these usages, which are operational invariants. Again, that's fairly standard psychological approach. So what that means is that early formulations of resource system in the documentational approach were, I think, influenced by this important distinction within the theory between the resource and the document. So that right back in the 2009 paper, we read each resource must be viewed as part of a wider set of resources, in brackets, used here instead of resource system, which suggests an a priori structure of the resource sets. In due course, however, the documentational approach embraced the term, using it in a particular way, and still maintaining this crucial distinction. So in a 2012 paper, the resource system of the teacher constitutes the resource part of her documentation system, brackets, i.e. without the scheme part of the documents. So again, this is developing in a consistent and coherent way within the theory, the notion of a resource system. And the rationale for this is that every time a resource is renewed, it has an impact on other teacher resources and may have other outcomes on the teacher resource system. So the word system is purposely chosen to emphasize the structuring of the system and that linkage of that structure to teachers' activity. That structuring may be directly attributable to the structure of the documentation system, as the next quote shows. But there is also a particular method that's characteristic of the documentational approach studies, which suggests other types of structuring of a teacher's resource system. And in this method, what the researcher does is to ask the teacher to draw a schematic representation of the resources that they use. And that's taken as being a schematic representation of the teacher's resource system. And typically, what this seems to elicit is spatio-temporal dimensions of the organization of teachers' work, as well as the form and function of resources. And I'll give you some examples, dimensions of teachers' representations of the resource system. So in an early paper, a teacher identifies four zones with which resources are associated. There's her work at home, her work at school without students, her work at school in the classroom with her students, and her work in in-service training collectives. And so we can see how this is a different social organization of the resources, as well as a kind of probably spatial and temporal connections there as well. In another study, a teacher's representation is configured first by the work site, whether it's home or school, and those are linked by the USB that carries things between the two. And then within the site, by the places where resources are kept. So for example, at home, shelves, bedroom, the computer, and also by the form of the resource, whether it's an email, books, scientific journals, paper folders, digital folders, kept together in the same place. Another example in that same study, a teacher groups resources first according to function, lesson preparation or communication with pupils and parents, then, to take the example of lesson preparation, according to their form, are they audiovisual and online resources, or games and similar activities, and sometimes status, whether it's the adopted textbook or other textbooks, or sometimes provenance, are they her own resources or do they come from colleagues? So what we see is a concept mapped which is structured by relatively immediate characteristics of the resources. So my critical reflection is that the documentational approach framework draws attention to two perspectives on teacher resource systems, one deriving from the theorization of teacher documentation systems with its focus on utilization schemes, another operationalized in terms of teachers' representations of their resource systems. And that comes out in the varied terms that teachers choose: socio-spatial temporal organization, form and function of the material resources. So it would be interesting and beneficial, I think, to further clarify the relationship between these perspectives within the documentational approach. The other thing I think would be really interesting is to explore congruences, complementarities, and conflicts between the documentational approach and theories of distributed cognition and situated knowledge, which also offer alternative, socioculturally informed accounts of the organization and development of professional knowledge. All these theories lead back in some way to Vygotsky. And so it's kind of be interesting to look at how these different Vygotsky-inspired theories might work together or not. So I think that would be an interesting project. So I'm going to now move to some concluding thoughts about resource systems in the work of teaching. My first thought is we've seen quite how versatile, how protean the notion of resource system is. We've seen ideas of resource system that differ considerably in the ways in which they demarcate resources. Are they just material, or is it a much more expansive notion? And in the ways in which they formulate system. So on the one hand, Euclidean, logico-mathematical, Durell's, didactico-pedagogical, the psychological notion of utilization scheme, or the concept map type teacher's representation of resource system, or the notion of resource system as defined simply around classroom patterns of use and teachers' thinking associated with them. Again, if we look closely, we see that different perspectives situate resource system in contrasting ways. So it can be adhering to a particular type of agent. That might be a teacher, but equally it could be a student, or I notice in one of the papers in the proceedings, it could be the designer, or is intervening between two or more of these agents. It can also be related to a specific educational entity, especially the classroom or the course or the lesson, or it can be seen as ranging across and beyond these. So professionals and researchers have clearly found each of these variations to be useful for some purpose, hence, why I think there's a value in it being a protean resource system. But my question is, could we benefit from a correspondingly overarching notion of resource system, which tries to map out some of these, if you like, variables within the notion of resource system? My other concluding thought is about what I think, up to date, in the research field at least, has been a particular focus on teachers. So both the structuring features and the documentational approach give particular attention to teachers in relation to resource systems. And that's not surprising, because both of them are essentially interested in the development of the professional knowledge of teachers. But I think there's scope to develop theories and methods which give greater attention to other agents. I know there are already people working on students' resource systems. And again, I think this would be a valuable broadening out of research in the field on resource systems in the work of teaching. So I'm going to conclude my formal talk at this point, having sort of planned to speak for 45 to 50 minutes, because I'm conscious that people might want to discuss some of the points that I've raised, and there may be some need also for some kind of time at the end of the session in order to, you know, to manage things. So thank you very much for your attention.